You are listening to the Radio Companion program for KTOO 360 TV's Thursday night program, Angst at 50, The Journey Continues. I'm Rhonda McBride. This is the third of a seven-part TV series that flashes back through old films, documentaries, and recorded conversations. This week's episode features a documentary produced by the Doyon Native Corporation, the early days in which some of Doyon's first leaders tell the story of the corporation's early struggles. One of those leaders is Emil Noddy, who was also a leader in the land claims fight and the first president of the Alaska Federation of Natives. Recently, he was inducted into the National Native American Hall of Fame. In good company with one other Alaskan, Elizabeth Paradovich, and other famous Native Americans like Jim Thorpe. I'd like to start off this program with the spotlight on Emil Noddy. Recently, I asked Nellie Moore and Jocelyn Estes, two longtime Alaska Native journalists, as well as Paul Onktuguk, who was for many years a professor of Alaska Native Studies, to weigh in. But first, I'd like to set the stage for our conversation and have you listen to some of Emil Noddy's speech to AFN in 1971, just before delegates voted to approve the Land Claims Act. It was classic Emil Noddy, humble, sincere, and full of gratitude.
It might be a good time to pause now to reflect over the past 5 years what's happened. And to begin with, I wonder if the people at the first convention would stand. Thank you. Let me say a few words about that first convention. John Borbidge gave you some history of what's happened in the past. 1899, when the first people went back east. And I'm amazed every time I read something like that, how early and how long this fight has been. I'm not too well-versed on the early fights. I first became involved in it after reading Willie Hensley's book, What Rights and Land Do Alaska Natives Has, that he wrote as a graduate student at the University of Alaska. Nick Gray was a great inspiration, whose dream was to have a statewide group.
Emil Noddy went on to talk about how the land claims fight gained momentum in 1967 when Native leaders learned the Bureau of Indian Affairs was drawing up what it called the final solution to the Native lands problem.
That was April of 67. About July of 67, some of us got to thinking about it and decided that if there's going to be a final solution to the land problem, Native people should have something to say about it. We wrote letters across the state to people we didn't know, people whose names we just heard. Jerome Trigg, Willie Hensley, Walter Soboloff, just to remember some of the names that I remember then, people I didn't know. And to think what's happened here, the friendships we've made and the people we've come to know from coming together, I think is one of the great happenings.
Emil Noddy went on to thank many others, Howard Rock, publisher of the Tundra Times newspaper, for keeping people informed about the land claims fight. He even thanked the AFN secretaries for their hard work, a reminder to the delegates about contributions big and small that led to this moment.
And I can remember Alice Brown standing up and saying, here's $200. I remember Larry Skolkoff standing up and saying, here's $200 more. And we went around the room within a half hour. We raised, $1,200 that sent Willie and I back to Washington, D.C. Those are the early sacrifices. How many board meetings did we hold in 67, 68, where people paid their own way into meetings, where they paid their own hotel rooms, where they took time away from their jobs? There have been many sacrifices and great expense to many people to bring this where we are today.
This speech also reveals another important quality of Emil Noddy's, his dry sense of humor.
Also, I remember Willie Hensley one time taken out a life insurance policy when he was a student, $10,000 life insurance policy, and he made AFN the beneficiary. And that's dedication. We're glad you're with us today, Willie.
So we have Jocelyn Estes, Nellie Moore, and Paul Ongtuguk with us. And I'd like to ask you, there are times in history when certain personalities make all the difference. And while Emil Nadi was one of many leaders, as he pointed out in that speech, Jocelyn, do you think that this was one of those cases where you have the right person in the right place at the right time?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, when you think about everybody who came to the first AFN meetings, it wasn't that long before that we were fighting each other over territory. And Emil Nadi came in, and he has a very calm, respectful, warm demeanor. He's very modest, and he's got a really good sense of humor. Now, he credits Nick Gray with the unification, getting people united enough to form the Alaska Federation of Natives. But I think it was Emil Nadi's personality that held it together. And one of the things that he did was he was very respectful and patient.
Well, I'd say that your observation of his demeanor is, you know, very accurate. For one thing, you know, his military background may have had something to do with it. He was in the Navy during the Vietnam War. He had gone to college, been through boarding school, and he earned his Bachelor of Science degree in Aeronautical and Electrical Engineering from Northrop University. He worked on the Minuteman missile project. And I was like, whoa. He came from Koyukuk, and, you know, that's really remote where he came from. And I think his upbringing may have had, or probably had, a lot to do with it, too.
So, Paul, do you think that Emil Nadi was the right person at the right time in the right place?
I've been more impressed by him each time that I've met him. And we've shared a couple of panels together talking about aspects of ANCSA. And one of the things that strikes me about him is he's always willing to share and point to other people in what they accomplished and how they performed and what key roles that they played in helping to pass ANCSA. And he's much more hesitant to bring up his vital role in making AFN into an organization that could not only cooperate occasionally, but could actually function as an organization in a very high stress environment. We tend to forget this is a small group of Alaska Natives who are in this breakneck historic battle with the oil corporations, multinational billion-dollar-plus corporations, with the state of Alaska in full opposition to ANCSA, with the federal government fragmented, parts of it for, other parts against. The Defense Department initially was not happy with the land claims because there was a concern that it might interfere with the training facilities that were such an important part of Alaska for the military, especially for the Air Force. And the conservationists came out of left field. Literally, they came out in opposition to Alaska Native claims. So any one of those organizations would have been a very difficult challenge. But to have all four of them as your initial opponents and to somehow negotiate anything that would be a reasonable settlement at all, it's near miraculous what they pulled off. It's not a total victory. It's not even close to that. I've always been concerned that there was a sense in which I think Emil was trying to help downplay this idea that ANCSA was a victory. It had elements of a victory, but it was really more along the lines of Dunkirk, where the British and French managed to pull 200,000 plus soldiers off of beaches while the Germans were surrounding them. And the miracle of Dunkirk was that they were able to do that. They were able to salvage this. And that's, I think, a better way to understand what angst is. It's a miracle of what was salvaged on behalf of Alaska Natives. And I think that was a very apt way in which he was trying to help moderate the sense of what was accomplished and give a sense that we won this round. Each generation of Alaska Natives is dealing with this ongoing set of issues of how do we protect our lands? How do we navigate a better future for us as peoples? How do we preserve and promote our own cultures and languages? How do we help people to feel confident about the role of being Alaska Natives and within our cultural groups as we move forward? And the resistance is always one of erosion, of assimilation. And Emil's just this remarkable person in this capacity to look at all of that and still calmly help people move forward.
I have a memory of Emil Nadi that I'd like to share. During the Sarah Palin administration, I had a chance to take a riverboat trip with him that started on the Koyukuk River and then wound up on the Yukon. And he had a stop somewhere along the Yukon. And we went through the woods in this bushy, grown over area. And he led us to this tiny cabin, the remnants of it. And he said, that was my father's general store. It was just a tiny cabin where there were some dry goods to supply miners. And that was where Emil Nadi's roots are. He grew up in a tiny village. And I don't think that the small village ever left the man after he went to the big city, that spirit stayed inside of him. What do you guys think?
Well, I think it took an enormous amount of determination. Paul mentioned that the natives were in opposition. Everybody opposed what the natives wanted. And it got to the point that Emil Nadi was getting death threats, and he actually had to have police protection for himself and his family. And this is when he's getting paid very little. So he was one of the people involved in this, but it sounds to me, you know, when I read back about and listen to interviews about those days, everybody sacrificed a great deal. Some people mortgaged their house or put a second mortgage on their house so that they could help finance the travel that people had to make to get back to Washington, D.C. and lobby. And then there's something else Emil Nadi did that really Southeast Alaska should be grateful for, and that is he voted to let the Tlingit and Haida be a part of the settlement, because there were groups that were arguing that because Tlingit and Haida had already received a cash settlement through the U.S. Court of Claims, their claims were over and done with, and they shouldn't be a part of this. It came up for a vote. It was a tie. Emil Nadi voted in favor. Otherwise, we wouldn't have Sea Alaska.
Well, he told me recently that he wasn't the smartest guy in the room, but felt that people could trust him. And maybe that was the key to being able to navigate, was that people trusted him. So, Nellie, you know, you have interviewed a lot of the leaders of ANCSA and Native Corporation leaders over the years, and there are a lot of big egos knocking around. Do you think that it probably took a person like Emil Nadi that was maybe a little more humble and quieter to steer everybody in the right direction?
Yeah, he worked on a number, I think, of projects that helped him become a team player and a group leader, and his personality strongly helped him through this process and probably calmed down some of the big wigs that were more bullish toward getting their own way, because you know that each of the corporations had to negotiate over when there was a border involved. Arctic Slope and Nana had to do Emo was, I think, one of the voices that was calming and helped out getting things squared away. And what made it more difficult was they were going before our national government lobbying for this act or some settlement. And when AFN started, they had $9 in the bank, according to Dermot Cole, who wrote an article for ADN. And they just struggled like crazy. And I'm sure that Emo had to really negotiate to make sure that they were able to stay in the limelight on that.
I want to thank Jocelyn Estes, Nellie Moore, and Paul Ondegook for their insights, because they have spent a good part of their lives tracking what happened after ANCSA was passed. And I also want to thank the Alaska Moving Image Preservation Association, also known as AMIPA, for use of sound from the footage of that pivotal 1971 AFN meeting. Nellie will be back for our next conversation on the birth of Native corporations.
Klingit and Haida, A and B.
Central Council of Southeast Alaska votes yes.
Central Council, Southeast Alaska votes yes. Bristol Bay.
Chairman, Last Native yes. Brotherhood vote yes.
The Klingit, Haida, A and B are together as yes. The next is Bristol Bay.
Yes.
You are listening to the companion program to KTOO 360 TV's ANCSA at 50 series, The Journey Continues. It airs on Thursday nights until December 18th, the 50th anniversary of ANCSA, and this is the third installment of the series, which looks at the birth of Native corporations. And there were two kinds, 13 regional corporations and about 200 village corporations. Nellie Moore, a veteran Alaska Native journalist, and Tim Bradner, probably Alaska's top natural resources reporter, will join us in a moment to add some context to that and talk about the differences between regional and village corporations. But first, I'd like to play some excerpts from one of the programs that will air in the third part of this series, The Diversity of Village Corporations, a conversation that was recorded between three village corporation leaders in 2018. You're about to hear Jared Godfrey with the Afognak Corporation. He was born after 1971, so he wasn't eligible to get stock in a Native corporation, but his siblings were, and they had some big decisions to make, like which village corporation to join. Listen.
And we were blessed with having directors, in particular in the late 70s, early 80s, and into the 90s, who they resisted the urge to pay out dividends from the timber revenue and put it in the bank. Even though they didn't know what they were going to do with that money, they knew it would probably be more prudent to hold on to it and invest in something in a future opportunity that would generate a sustainable revenue stream. And as a sidebar, I always tell this story. I was the only person in my house who wasn't a shareholder, because both my mom and dad were both Koniag, and my dad was a Afognak and my mom was Yuzinki, the rival village. And my three siblings were shareholders. It was ironic. My mom, as so many people back when it came time to register, what's this ANCSA thing? What does this mean to be shareholder? Because my siblings who were born in time, or alive at the time when ANCSA passed, my mom was given the option of registering them or enrolling them with Afognak or with Yuzinki. And they tell the story, and I remember it in high school and didn't care much because I was kind of bitter because I didn't have any shares. But I remember them telling the story, which is my mom asked my dad, which village corporation should we register them with? Because they get to be regional. They're all cognac, but, and he says, I don't know. I don't know what it even matters. I don't know what any of this is about. My dad was barely out of high school. What does he know? And so she said, well, they have your last name and you're their father, so I think it's appropriate for me to register them with you, and that would be a Fognac. Fast forward to the 1990s. I remember being back from college. At that point, I still had no shares. And I remember my mom looking at my dad and waving around a check. She just checked the mail. You see, Yuzinki had the same timber allotment a Fognac did, the two rival villages. And we were harvesting them together, jointly. And my mom was walking around waving a $25,000 check in my dad's face, going, woohoo, this is what my village corporation did for me. And my dad had essentially a pittance, $250. And yet everyone in Port Lyons and Yuzinki knew you're selling the same timber, long short out on the same barges. These guys are getting brand new outboards and boats. They're getting 150 horsepower skiffs. And over here, you're giving us $250. And so what you had is a board of directors that had to resist a lot of pressure, where they had people in the village who were shareholders who had cousins that were in Yuzinki shareholders that were doing really well. And the comment my dad said at the time, maybe we registered the kids with the wrong village corporation.
Jared Godfrey says the payoff came many years later when a Fognac jumped into what's known as 8A contracting, a program under the Small Business Administration. The money that a Fognac had socked away gave them the capital to get into government contracting, a program that has made a Fognac a very wealthy corporation. Another village corporation, Kavilko in Kasan in southeast Alaska, got its start in timber as well. Gene Brennick, who serves on the board of directors, talks about the early windfall from timber.
We did sell our timber 6 years after we became incorporated, and we sold it at really the height of the timber market for $25 million, and we did distribute $25,000 apiece to each shareholder. And then not only that, we created what was called a debenture program, which guaranteed every shareholder with 100 shares $10,000 a year for 10 years. And I have to say that I benefited greatly from that because I was a college student at the time. My husband was a starving pilot just starting out. We just started our family. I was a student. And if it wasn't for that $10,000 a year, plus scholarships, that really helped make my education. It helped bring me up through the ranks so that I could finish and end up where I am here today. But as Jared points out, the board of directors at that time asked themselves, how do we maintain our principal and not have to sell our land and eat up what we have left of our capital to actually pass something on to our kids? We want the future generations to benefit from this, too. So at that time, there was a big investigation and looking into how to maintain this revenue stream, dividends, on a regular basis for people. And so what happened is we voted to become a registered investment company.
Some of the smaller village corporations far outperformed the larger ones. But Nathan McGowan, the CEO of the Native Corporation for St. George Island, says most fledgling corporations didn't see those kind of windfalls.
The majority of village corporations are like mine. The land was valuable to them. Obviously, it had subsistence qualities, it had traditional, these are our homelands. But they did not have immediate ability to become monetized. They didn't have immediate ability to create capital that you could then deploy and do other things with. So St. George Island, for instance, you know, the lands we received, what we did with them initially is that we would be building structures that cater to the fishing industry out there, primarily Apelio crab and some other onshore value-added activities. You know, we were very lucky because we're sitting right in the middle of the Bering Sea. You know, there's over 100 village corporations which didn't have any of those natural advantages.
These excerpts from the program, The Diversity of Village Corporations, can give you just a glimpse of all the different experiments and lessons learned since ANCSA was born. And that is what Nellie Moore and Tim Bradner are here to talk about. you know, I've heard this said, and I'm interested to hear what you think, that the Claims Act was kind of a product of a shotgun marriage. There were people that wanted the pipeline to be built but didn't necessarily care about Native land rights. Yet, the pipeline did open the door for the first time to serious negotiations about Native land rights. So, Nellie and Tim, to say that ANCSA was kind of a shotgun marriage, do you think that is a good analogy, a good way to describe it?
I think so, Rhonda. I remember Emil Noddy remarking once at one of our ANCSA 40 panels, and I think Willie Hinsey sort of chimed in on this. He was on the same panel. The feeling, just as the Claims Act was coming to a, ready to be finalized, what they knew they did not want reservations, anything but reservations. The idea of corporations sort of came out of that mix. It wasn't anybody's real first choice, but there'd been some familiarity with it. As Emil had explained at the time, because of in the 1930s, there were village stores and corporations formed by the BIA. So there was a little bit of knowledge of it. But the one thing that everybody seemed to be uniform about is they did not want reservations like existed in the lower 48. Out of that came this unique structure of corporations that were designed with the regions and the villages. And that seems to have been a product of Scoop Jackson's staff came up with that idea back in the kind of the back rooms. And the AFN board at the time, and I'm recounting what I remember Willie and Emil saying, at the time the AFN board, they weren't in the room. You know, the doors opened and the senators walked out and said, this is our deal. But they were so anxious to get the control of the lands that they accepted the structure that went with it, which was this corporate structure. It was really something new to a lot of people. Their main focus was getting control of the land. You know, the structure of the corporations and how to administer that land wasn't really at front burner at the time. They were so anxious to get the land and get that part of it done. That was the real urgent burning priority at the time. Of course, the obvious question is, what is the governance? How do you administer this thing? But I recall Emil saying that the one thing that they were unified on is they did not want reservations, but nobody had a really clear idea of what that was. It was also clear, though, that the corporations, which seemed to be the most practical way to do it, and it kind of came out of the staff.
There had been a lot of back and forth among the people who were negotiating. You know, one senator would say this and another senator would come up with that. And so there was a lot of complicated information going from one side of the hallway to the other. And if it probably weren't for the Tundra Times, you know, people in the rural areas outside of the board, you know, had no idea what was happening. So that was one newspaper that really, really covered ANCSA. And people didn't really rise up in arms about what they finally came up with. I think they were tired of it and were happy the negotiating had come to an end.
It was really a huge accomplishment, though. I mean, just getting the lands, in my opinion, it's one of the most significant pieces of natural resource legislation and certainly minority rights legislation in history. It's a huge amount of land. It also led to other things like Anoka. It led directly to Anoka in the establishment of national parks and refuges in Alaska. So it was hugely significant. And I recall that at the time, Emil made the comment that it was just a quirk of history, that the politics were just right, the timing was just right. Had it happened 10 years later, 10 years earlier, the claim settlement would have been much different. You had a friendly national administration initially in the Democratic Johnson administration and Stuart Udall as Secretary of the Interior. And then at the end, you had Richard Nixon, who was interested in American Indian affairs and justice to American Indians. So I think it was a coincidence, good timing, good politics, that it happened when it did and how it happened.
In some ways, people have wondered if the Native corporations were sort of set up to fail because they didn't get their land right away. They didn't get their money right away in all cases.
Well, I remember a lot of discussion about this, Rhonda, but in the end, they succeeded, and that's what's important. I mean, there were a lot of problems, a lot of money that they had to spend. The agencies dragged their feet in terms of, at least in the opinion of the regional corporations and the village corporations, the federal land agencies dragged their feet in terms of making the conveyances. But, you know, it took a long time, but it's happened now. The land's conveyed mostly.
Right. You know, they're starting out with something that's very unfamiliar to them. I remember some of early leaders of Chilista talking about how many of the people that were on their initial board had never had a bank account or had a checkbook. So it was a very different group of people coming to the table with this new thing that was called Native Corporation, this new entity. And maybe we should backtrack a bit, Nellie. Of course, you grew up in Kotzebue. What do you remember about the beginning after ANCSA was passed?
Well, I remember there was a big rush to get people, and I'm not exactly sure when this occurred, but it was right around then, when people made their selections for their native allotments, which was a totally separate act. And following that, the native corporations had done a lot of exploration and seismic testing and everything to try to decide what they might want to select. Of course, the state was trying to select their lands, and the feds wanted lands too. So they all started identifying traditional lands, traditional use lands, like where they caribou hunted or where they had cultural significance, maybe a burial grounds. So they were going around to the different corporations, and there was a lot of work going on. I mean, there were deadlines they were trying to meet, and they were all trying to select the best land that they could to make money. And so, and to preserve, you know, what people wanted for their own inheritance type land. So there was a lot going on.
So how old were you in 1971, Nellie?
Do I have to say? I was 16. I had just graduated from high school. I was getting ready to go to Fairbanks, and that was when I went to work at a small newspaper and got to know Tundra Times a little bit, and Tom Snapp, who was very active with the All Alaska Weekly covering what was going on with ANCSA and trying to keep up with such a complicated, huge topic.
Well, these days, we don't get a lot of Native coverage. The mainstream news doesn't spend a lot of time on Native issues. And back then, there was probably very little coverage in the major publications in Alaska. So Howard Rock's Tundra Times was probably a big part of this whole process of winning the ANCSA battle.
Yeah, that's for sure. People, you know, really felt it was their communications device. I mean, in Kotzebue, we were a relatively large village, and we only had, well, sometimes you could get a church station from Nome or somewhere else, but the station that came in the best was Armed Forces Radio, and they weren't covering it. So, yeah, we needed the Tundra Times.
Did the Tundra Times help out much once ANCSA was passed in informing people about what the next steps would be?
Nellie, I think the Tundra Times had fallen on hard times even during the Claims Act. I know this because I was in Fairbanks working in the newspaper business at the time. And I even briefly worked at the Tundra Times myself. And it was very difficult financially. It was started back in the 1960s with the support of a well-known philanthropist from the East Coast. And over the years, he just decided he had to cut making his contributions, and the Tundra Times had to stand on its own. And gradually, the finances of the paper became worse and worse. And so after the Claims Act, it was around for a while. Tom Richards became the editor and I think did a good job of covering some of the aftermath of the passage of the act. But there was also a feeling that it's kind of its time had passed, because it was primarily a vehicle that helped get the Claims Act passed. And once that happened, there was a feeling, even among a lot of Alaska Native people, that they really kind of, they didn't need something like that anymore. They were so regionally focused. They didn't have an interest in a statewide perspective like that. Nellie, what do you think?
Another weird thing that happened was the Tundra Times Board decided that they no longer wanted alcohol ads in the paper. And that was another huge financial blow to the Tundra Times. So Yeah, it did just dwindle and die out, unfortunately.
Yeah, that was an interesting decision, though, because that really showed moral fiber to make a decision based on values, suffering the commercial consequences. So in that sense, you got to hand it to them.
That's too bad that that happened, because it sounds like it was a really chaotic time and the paper was really needed to help people navigate. So, for example, what were some of the problems in even trying to sign up for a corporation? That must have been very difficult.
Yeah, and one way, you know, that it really showed is that if you were a native living in Anchorage, you could enroll to, say, NANA, if you were from Kotzebue, and you could enroll, or you could enroll in CERES, a local Native corporation. So by that very selection, they enrolled to a corporation, CERES, which handed out huge dividends, and NANA, who handed out very few dividends and not very large. So some people, you know, to a certain extent, felt a little bit cheated by that. But yeah, there were splits in families. One of my cousins is enrolled to Siri, and most of the rest of us are enrolled to NANA.
Boy, it does sound like there are a lot of choices to be made. But perhaps we should backtrack so people understand that there are two different types of corporations that you could be a member of. You could be a member of a Native corporation and a village corporation. So do we know why there were two different types of corporations set up? What's the story on that?
This probably goes back into the murky history of how the structure was put together in that back room in the U.S. Senate. And there are probably people who remember the details of how that came about. But you know, conceptually, I guess the idea, it makes sense that there would be an entity that would look after the region as a whole, and then each community could have their own organization. In these days, when village corporations are doing business as in 8A contracts and are making some are very profitable, and you have people getting dividends from both village corporation and the regional corporations.
Aside from the fact that the regional corporation is bigger than the village corporation, is there any other difference between them?
The regional corporations would own the subsurface, what's underground, and the village corporations would own the surface, which is not where most of the minerals or any kind of development could be, unless it was, you know, something they built or whatever. It can be a very confusing thing to try to understand if you're an outsider and don't know what's what.
But despite those complications, I think it's amazing that it's worked as well as it has. For example, Calista region, Calista Corporation owns the subsurface rights at the Donlin Gold Project, which is a big mine that's in development. That's very valuable. These surface lands are owned by a consortium of village corporations in the area called TKC Corporation, which is and actually the two kind of work together, or they seem to work together very well. Calista would be getting the mineral royalty from the gold production once it starts and sharing that with other corporations. TKC has its agreements with the mining company to do certain kinds of services and contracting, much like NANA has with Red Dog, and make profits that way. So I think they kind of have it divided up. There's a lot of things going on in that area. Amazing. It seems very complicated, but people have a way of figuring it out and making it work.
Tim, what I think is so interesting about it is it's almost sort of like this system of checks and balances were set up, where power was sort of distributed and that the regionals had the subsurface rights, but they couldn't access, in some cases, that subsurface resource without working with the village corporation, which owned the surface rights. Was that by design, or?
I don't know. I don't know.
It was my understanding that when they were going through the creation of ANCSA and they were talking about the regional and the village corporations, that they wanted them to work together. That was part of a togetherness thing.
So I guess it was by design then, and it's just been very interesting, the results, because in some cases, the larger regional corporations not doing as well in some cases as some of the village corporations. That's an interesting result.
And I think for every region, it's a little bit different. And some of them have almost no resource development or way to make a lot of money. One thing about the dividends, as far as Nana region is concerned, the smaller villages all merged together with Nana, because a lot of it was because they were so small. Kobuk, for example, only had 60 people living there, and they received their money from ANCSA based on population. Kotzebue, on the other hand, had, at the time, I think about 2,000, and they thought that since there were so many shareholders, they might be able to make it on their own. At the time, I think it was Al Adams was the president of Kotzebue Village Corporation, or KIC. And the village corporations got 200 shares of Nana. The shareholders each got 200 shares of Nana because they didn't merge with Kotzebue. Kotzebue got 100 shares of Nana. Shareholder got 100 shares. So the way it's worked out is Nana hasn't always made a huge profit, but in a lot of ways, they're handing out dividends based on 100 shares. And in the villages, they're handing out dividends based on 200 shares a shareholder. So if I haven't confused you all already, it's kind of crazy.
Some regions made an effort to get their village, small village corporations to consolidate so that they're into the regional corporation. And Nana's an example of that for the reasons Nellie pointed out. But even within the Nana region, Kotzebue decided to stay on its own. And I think, you know, there was a feeling that people wanted to kind of have, run their own affairs and did not want to have the big brother of the regional corporation looking over their shoulder. But in most cases, the villages wanted to stay independent. And that's why you see them existing, 200 of them as there are today.
I think there is another distinction between the village corporations and the regionals. And it's that the regionals have to share their profits and the village corporations don't benefit from the profit sharing mechanism. So maybe this would be a good time to talk about what the profit sharing mechanism was.
Rhonda, maybe I could speak to that a little. The Section 7I of the Claims Act requires that 30% of the natural resource revenues of regional corporations be shared with all other regional and village corporations. So, for example, the Red Dog Mine is very profitable. 70% of the net revenues are shared with all other village and regional corporations. In some instances, individuals that are at-large shareholders. And the same is true of the oil royalties that Arctic Slope receives, some timber receipts from Sea Alaska. So the 7I revenue sharing has been very important.
The other thing, too, is that corporations like Nana that are doing 7i sharing, they also get a 7i share.
Well, that's true. Yeah, they get their share. But that's an absolutely unique feature that nowhere else in the world has that been done. Of course, there's nowhere else in the world has anything like ANCSA been done. It's totally unique. I think it's an amazing experiment that's in the end is working fairly well.
What I think is so unique about it is that each corporation more or less has a unique story. In some cases, completely different paths to trying to build an economy, earn money. And to me, it's amazing that this legislation would have made that possible.
Well, nobody could have foreseen what was going to happen. It was totally unique. It was a real experiment. But just going back to the root of it, though, the real objective of people was to get control of the land, because they were concerned that if they didn't, other people were going to take the land.
Well, there was a lot of fear that people would eventually lose their land. And there was a lot of risk involved because they didn't necessarily have the expertise, all the challenges that people had to manage from not being familiar with economics, the money world. It was brand new to them. And I wonder if the profit sharing was key to keeping everybody afloat to make it to this 50-year milestone.
Rhonda, the answer is yes. 7i revenue sharing has helped sustain many, many of the small village corporations. they wouldn't have been able to sustain their administrative expenses and look after their lands without that the benefit of that 7i revenue sharing.
But this idea that everybody's sharing profits together, that to me is such an unusual concept.
As I recall the discussion, Rhonda, I was a reporter at the time, and I remember interviewing people and hearing discussion of it, that everybody knew that when the lands were divvied up, that there were going to be winners and losers, that some regions are going to wind up with land that had minerals. Some regions were going to wind up with land that had timber or oil. So how do you work out the unfairness? And many other regions would wind up with lands that had no mineral. How do you handle that? And I think it was brilliant what somebody came up with the idea of revenue sharing and made it work.
It was whispered around that this corporation or that corporation only stayed afloat because of 7i. So, yeah.
Certainly helped keep the doors open. You know, what's important is it kept a little bit of cash coming in that allowed them to hire people to protect the lands, to look after the land administration.
It seems that overall, there were more successes than there were bad outcomes because our whole economy has benefited. I mean, you look at the property taxes that Native corporations pay, you look at the jobs that they generate that Natives and non-Natives alike benefit from. I've heard some people say that actually non-Natives may have benefited more from ANCSA than Alaska Natives. What do you think when you hear something like that?
Well, I think you look at the range of the ANCSA corporations as a major stimulant of the Alaska economy and business sector. Look at all the businesses that Alaska Native corporations have bought and are now owned. For example, Alaska Industrial Hardware is an old line, mainline operating hardware outfit in Anchorage with several branches. It's owned by Bering Straits Corporation. A lot of people don't know that. Of course, it was purchased by the former owners that wanted to sell it to somebody. So rather than sell it to an out-of-state investor, they sold it to Bering Straits. They kept it within the state. Many of the businesses that Calista owns, the barge companies, construction companies, are companies that were sold to them that they bought into and they co-invested. And they're now thriving businesses that employ people, Natives and non-Natives. Doyon went into Doyon Drilling first as a joint venture and then bought out their partners. And now Doyon for years has operated Doyon Drilling, very successful drilling company, a good employer, pays good salaries, very high shareholder hire ratio. But just in a visual sense, anybody driving around Anchorage and looking at the office buildings around town, look at who owns them, look at the names of the Native corporations on the side of the office buildings. I mean, that tells the story more than anything.
You've covered business for years in Alaska for most of your life. And one of the things that you hear a lot about is Alaska businesses have a tough time growing beyond a certain point, that they have tough times getting capital for their investments. And in many cases, Native corporations have bought Alaska companies and helped them to get to the next level. So do you think that that's important and overlooked?
That's exactly true, Rhonda. In most cases, they didn't necessarily buy all of the Alaska companies, but they bought into them and they became partners with the Alaskan owners. And in many cases, eventually the Alaskan owners retired and sold the rest of the company to the Native corporation. That was the case with Doyon Drilling, for example. But that's exactly true. This is a large pool of resident investment capital that likes to invest in Alaska. And partly because they invest in real estate in Anchorage, or they buy companies, they can walk down the street and see their assets. It's not as if they're investing in the stock market. They're investing in the stock market anyway, but to have a good portion of their assets right here at home.
You know, if you talk to the average person on the street and ask them about the importance of Native corporations, they probably wouldn't be able to tell you very much, and they probably wouldn't realize that most of the top 49 Alaska-owned companies in terms of gross revenue are Alaska Native corporations. You see lots of Native corporation names on this list sprinkled in occasionally by another company. I mean, they're the top three this year. And then there's Linden, which is number four. And then Chenega is number five. Chugach, Alaska, number six. Chelista, number seven. The list goes on. We must be benefiting from this if these are the top companies in Alaska.
We are, Rhonda, but you know what strikes me about this is how mainstream the Alaska Native corporations have become, that people, you know, people just accept it. You know, they are a big part of our economy. We don't have to look at the Alaska Business Monthly list to know that. You just look at the names on the side of the office buildings. But, you know, it's just part of our economy now. It's become so routine that people don't think it's unusual.
So on this 50th anniversary of ANCSA, Nellie, what rises to the top for you?
I think it's been a saving grace for Alaska. Without ANCSA, I don't think the economy would be as vibrant as it has been, like you noted from the list of 49ers. So I think we have something to celebrate and something to continue to work on. It, you know, ANCSA hasn't been unchanged. It's kind of a living document. So I guess it all depends on what kind of issues we face in the future. I mean, geez, look, people are, for a mere $250,000, you can jump in a missile and take off and come back in the same day into outer space. So who knows?
Right. Things that we can't even imagine, sort of like the ANCSA journey, right? But going forward on that journey, on that ANCSA journey, Nellie, what would you like to see happen?
Well, I hope they continue to increase their hiring of natives. I just hope that our children will see the benefits and reap the benefits and end up having a good life, you know, a way to get a good job and have a good life.
This program and the 360 TV series, ANCSA at 50, The Journey Continues, has been a collaboration between KTOO, the Alaska Native Media Group, and the Alaska Moving Image Preservation Association. Thanks to Nellie Moore and Tim Bradner for joining us for this last segment. Both of them have followed Alaska Native corporations as journalists for many, many years. And we have only scratched the surface here, but one thing I hope that you come away with is that ANCSA is a work in progress. I'm Rhonda McBride. Thank you for joining us for ANCSA at 50, The Journey Continues.